Get it started. I'll take it from there.
Well, you're not taking it anywhere, dead wife. Not without me. Not until that coin is back in my pocket where it belongs.
Good fucking luck with that. No, this one. Not that one.
That alarm I can't do anything about. This alarm I can. This alarm's my friend.
Steal me a different fucking car. I don't want to drive this shitty old taxi.
I'm driving. You're in the back. I've done the math. This times that equals your account. Divided by the only way I'm going to get what I need is if you give it to me. Equals the only way you're going to give it to me is if you don't need it. Like my friend, Jesus Christ, the only thing you need, dead wife, is resurrection.
Hello and welcome to Storm of Spoilers. You stumbled upon an 8-episode miniseries dedicated to the Starz TV show American Gods. I'm Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Gail Folsom.
Each week we, two book readers and amateur Neil Gaiman experts, will unpack the latest episode of American Gods. Despite the name of this podcast, we will not be spoiling anything in this podcast episode beyond Season 1, Episode 6, A Murder of Gods, directed by Adam Kane, written by Brian Fuller and Michael Green. Usually this is the part of the episode where we dive into listener feedback. We didn't get much feedback this week, except we did have a couple people accurately call what that chair thing was. I mean, I think we discussed that it might be Mr. Wood, didn't we? Or we talked about Mr. Wood in last week's podcast.
Yeah.
And then in this week's episode, we find out that that was Mr. Wood, which is just like a completely different take.
Real out of left field.
Yeah. So anyway, we had a couple people tweeted us. And someone actually tweeted over concept art, which I actually couldn't tell from the tone of their tweet whether or not they were being sarcastic. But so Mr. Wood, indeed, was the chair thing that attacked Shadow, and we will get into that a little later on in this episode. But if you have anything you want to email us, you can email us stormofspoilers@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter @stormofspoilers or @JoeWroteThis or @ClockworkRose. So we are going to start with, as we often do, with the Coming to America vignette. When I saw this, like, I think I've told you guys before that Starz locked me in a room and showed me a bunch of stuff like months ago. And like, they showed me all of the Coming to America vignettes. And so I saw this one.
Make it sound so Clockwork Orange.
Nothing was prying my eyes open. I had water. I was fine. But I saw all the Coming to America vignettes. And this one was, the file name was just called Mexican Jesus. So.
I'm sorry.
No,
it's not funny. It still sounds like a drink to me.
No, it's kind of funny. Like, well, I got excited when I saw it. Like, I saw it down the list. I'm not sure I was supposed to see the file names, but I looked at them anyway. And like, I knew down the list there was one called Mexican Jesus, and I was like, oh, Mexican Jesus. And like, I have to say, I got really excited when Jesus showed up. And when I was watching it again with my roommate the other night with Diana, like, we both got excited. We're like, oh, it's Jesus. Like, I was so happy to see him.
Yeah, like seeing like a face that you know in like a French movie. Like when you watch, you know, you're watching like, I don't know, City of Lost Children. You're like, oh, my God, Ron Perlman. It's like, I know that guy.
I was also thinking sort of like, it's like seeing Elvis. I was like, yeah, Jesus is here.
Or like seeing Stan Lee in a Marvel movie. Oh, my God.
So this is not just any Jesus. This is Mexican Jesus, which sort of builds on that speech that Wednesday gave in the copy shop earlier this season about how there's a different Jesus for every culture or group or belief.
Talk about your franchise.
I don't think this is a spoiler to say that the actor Jeremy Davies, who I just adore, has also been cast as Jesus. He is not Mexican Jesus, but he is, I mean, probably I could just call him White Jesus if I want to. And he'll show up later. But this is Mexican Jesus. We see him sort of help this man who's drowning as he's trying to like come to America. And then they approach some, you know, not official border patrol, it seems like to me, but some people monitoring the border who do not want these Mexican immigrants coming in. Jesus gets shot in his hand, in his chest. He dies. Some of the other immigrants die. Some live. And I was fully on board for all of it. The like glowing wound in Mexican Jesus's chest, the stigmata bullet wound, all of that, until a tumbleweed rolled by over Jesus and put a crown of thorns on his head. I was like, you did not need that. Was
we got it already.
So unnecessary. I was like, this show is not subtle. This show is never subtle. But I was like, you could have just let me have that one. I was feeling it. I was feeling the death of Mexican Jesus. And then that stupid tumbleweed came by and I was off board. So, Gail, we've talked before about, I mean, do you consider yourself a Catholic, or how would you like to?
I consider myself a Catholic in the cultural sense. Like, okay. I mean, so for you, dear listener, I was raised Catholic. The larger part of my family is not Catholic. I have a large extended family. Most of them are not Catholic, but my dad was raised Catholic, and at some point was just like, I think we should send our children to Catholic schools. They are very good schools. I was raised Catholic. I'm comfortable with this. My mom was like, sure, sign me up. And I was in fourth grade. My younger brothers were, too young to remember this. We all like went through catechism, got baptized, and started going to Catholic schools. And then, you know, very faithfully went to church every Sunday. And I later taught at a Catholic school, actually. Yeah, I'm very, very familiar with Catholicism. I have largely good feelings toward it because I've had very positive experiences with Catholicism. I did want to say, though, I think this is very, I'm not a good Catholic, though. Like, full disclosure, I don't go to church anymore. But I did want to share, like, in the sort of multiple Jesuses discussion. So in studying, I majored in art as well, and I minored in art history. And if you're going to minor in art history, you're probably going to study a whole lot of Jesus paintings. So I'm also very familiar with like depictions of Jesus, from a, you know, a wide variety of cultures, not just Western art, not just European art. The Catholic school that I taught at was also in a predominantly Latino school. Mm-hmm. So lots of different depictions of Jesus and sort of associations with Jesus and the different saints and, you know, sort of cultural focuses. I did at one point find, and I've lived in California my whole life. That's another like piece of that puzzle. I found at one point in my classroom, this is an old school. The school itself is about 125 years old and it's a mission school. So this was a weird thing to find in this school. It was a Bible, a children's illustrated Bible that had been printed in like, I don't know, it was like the early, early 60s. And Jesus was so blonde. And you don't see that anymore. This Jesus had like bright white blonde hair and bright blue eyes. And like the more acceptable Jesus, like the worldwide whatever Jesus is, he typically has like brown hair. And most of the time, you know, in America, you see him, he's white. He's got brown hair. And he usually has like brown to hazel to grayish eyes. This Jesus had piercing blue eyes and like bright gold hair.
You're like, oh, it's, you know, there.
Yeah. It was like, oh, balder Jesus. So like, yeah, it was really weird. And he was like, this wasn't a misprint. He was like that in every single picture. And it kind of hammered home to me because we also in this school, you know, having like a large Latino, majority Latino population, we also had a large Vietnamese population. So we had different depictions of Mary and different depictions of Jesus in the school. And this was the first one where I've been like, oh, right. There was a thing for a long time there and still is a for Aryan Jesus, super duper inaccurate Aryan Jesus.
Well, okay. So the reason I asked you about your sort of like your personal faith, and we all know that I'm a like dirty heathen, but like, you know, you obviously have had a different relationship with Jesus. That sounds weird, but like, you know, than I have in my life. Here's what I'm trying to like get around. I think, you know, Neil Gaiman had Jesus in his original American Gods book, and then he left Jesus out. Like he wrote Jesus in, and then he took Jesus out.
Are you okay the original upset about Jesus? American hard, Gods. Hard to talk about Jesus.
And I think, you know, I'm sure at one point I knew why, and whether or not he's been entirely forthright as to why, I think what's true is that when you're watching a fantastical show and there's Vulcan and there's Odin and there's like whatever, which are not gods that any of us have like, that kind of go to church every day. Well, most of us, I'm not going to make assumptions about you, dear listener, but it's just different. If it's Jesus,
well, and also,
you know, and like they're for not people, just... not for me, but for some people, like, well, like it reminds me of that scene in Dogma where I forget what the context is, but I think it's, the main female character. I think she refers to it as mythology. And I think it's Chris Rock's character who's like, you know, he gets kind of mad when you call him mythology. Like, Jesus is different. Like, Jesus is not mythology. I think of Jesus as mythology, but a lot of people don't. And so, like, to do Jesus, not just here, but as he will appear later in the season, like, is kind of gutsy. But then, you know, this is an episode, like, you know, this is a show that, like, you know, is like, make that genie sex gayer, and also like make very strong comments about gun control in this particular episode. So like, you know, it's not ashamed
it's
of
not
it.
Shying away.
Exactly. So it's not afraid of offending the people who are maybe more precious about their depictions of Jesus. Like, I can see some people getting offended by the fact that there even is a Mexican Jesus or a black Jesus or whatever.
Oh my God.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So like,
And having said that, like, whole piece about Aryan Jesus, I actually think it's perfectly reasonable. I mean, if you actually buy into the tenets of your basic Catholicism or Christianity, you should understand that, like, Jesus, according to the rules, doesn't really belong to any one place or people. So this should be fine with everyone. I was also kind of like, oh, this is sort of ballsy. But I also think that one of the reasons that it feels a little odd to us culturally to be just like, Jesus, lump him in with all these guys, is because part of the storyline, like part of the premise of this story is that these gods are all sort of like failing and slightly pathetic in one way or another. And there are charlatans and they're like scrabbling in the dirt for their very survival. It's another, like, not only are they all like completely at the mercy of their human, and it's discussed in this episode too, their human creators possibly, but they're not particularly admirable, and that's kind of Jesus's whole thing, is to like be a really good guy. So I think it was a kind of gutsy thing to do, and I don't think we'll probably ever know Neil Gaiman's true reasons for leaving Jesus out. But it might also have been, frankly, that he felt, I probably would, just, you know, with the culture that we live in, sort of uncomfortable taking on such a big and loaded subject, because yes, there are people who are still adhering to Odinism, but have you met any lately?
We know someone.
We actually do. So.
Like, when I was saying that, I was like, oh damn, we know someone. So never mind. But you know, our friend who, you know, has that relationship with Odin aside, like, there's a million reasons why Neil Gaiman might have cut Jesus out of the book. Like, I really do think his party line is that it didn't flow. And I can't talk about where Jesus shows up because it's a spoiler, but like, knowing what I do about that Jesus scene, you know, like maybe Gaiman decided not to do it. Maybe his publisher, maybe Harper was like, you know what? Can we lose the Jesus? Maybe, you know, like who knows? So anyway, Jesus was out, but now he's back in. And that is our Coming to America, which I quite liked that scene, except for the tumbleweeds.
It's just tumbleweeds.
And it's worth noting that the people shooting at the border are using Vulcan bullets, like, you know, the camera zooms in on the Vulcan branding on the bullets. So,
although interestingly, they're all obviously, well, I mean, they're Catholic, to be very specific. You don't use rosaries if you're not Catholic. So that's an interesting little point.
Oh, that the people firing the guns were Catholic.
Unless the show just doesn't understand how that works.
No, I'm sure it does. But maybe, you know, I mean, if we want to get up our own asses about this a little bit, we can, which is like to say, I mean, well, first we should note that great shot of the headlights sort of giving Jesus his corona before you find out that that's just headlights. You know what I mean? Like, he's like, you know, you already know my name. And then he's like backlit and you're like, oh, and then it's like, no, it's headlights. Nope. Holy shit. And then the other thing is, yeah. If we want to get up our own asses about it, why wouldn't we? That's what podcasting is for. You know, we could say, okay, this is about, and this is a very, you know, apropos discussion in our current political climate, but you know, it's about American culture not wanting to let other culture in and saying like our white Jesus probably given those people on the border is the right Jesus and you and your Mexican Jesus are not welcome here. So
having just nitpicked that, this is just like a personal story that maybe no one will find funny at all, but my husband is not religious at all and wasn't raised particularly religiously. And so while I'm like nitpicking the rosary wrapped around that guy's hand, Scott's only takeaway from like his only like nitpicky thing was in a later scene, he was like, all those shell casings falling to the ground, a lot of them are just bullets. Like you guys couldn't find shell casings. And sort of a funny juxtaposition.
Gun fact checking.
The things we notice.
Yes. so before we get to Vulcan, Virginia, we have to rewind to we pick up sort of where we left off last week. Shadow and Wednesday have escaped from the precinct. They're out on the road. There's the billionth talk about Faith. You know, which they're not uninteresting, and like Ian McShane does the best with his lines, but it's sort of like the question that this first scene between the two of them raises to me is like, well, it's just a really hard position the show is in because the show is committed to Shadow not knowing who Wednesday is, you know, and he even asks him point blank again in this episode, and Wednesday says, if I told you, you wouldn't believe me. And so it's this whole thing of like Shadow is or Wednesday is laying down track so that he tells Shadow at the right moment so that when he does tell Shadow, Shadow goes, I believe you, you know, because like Wednesday's pursuit of people of believers is a big part of this episode and other episodes. So that makes sense from Shadow's perspective, but from a show perspective,
from literally anyone else's perspective,
it's nonsense. And once again, it really does highlight, this episode particularly, I think really highlights the complete lack of consistency as to what really freaks Shadow out and what
doesn't. Thank you. Yes. I especially in this first scene when they're walking down the road, I kept thinking of what you had said about in the last episode about how very surprised he was to see Marilyn Monroe float in the door. And I was like, really, Shadow? Yeah. And he keeps bringing up in this episode, he brings up Laura quite a bit and he brings her up in this scene as well. You know, having seen his dead wife return from the grave. And like in the context of this conversation with Wednesday, I was like, okay, Shadow, you said it out loud. Your dead wife came back. What still surprises you?
Right.
Even Laura in a later scene is like, well, actually, nothing quite surprised. I'm like annoyed when you don't tell me what I want to know, but none of this is particularly surprising.
Right. Yeah,
Laura's, all bets are off.
Laura's attitude, I'm back from the dead and what anything goes, makes so much more sense to me than whatever it is we see shadowed.
Yeah, I don't want to be dead. I don't want to be a zombie. But basically watching Laura's, for me, especially in this episode, I was just sort of like, yeah, girl. I was just like more and more and more on Laura's team about everything.
Yes, absolutely. And what I do like about this scene, because we see, you know, Wednesday very sort of concocting a bunch of lies around, like, to explain away Laura's appearance, and then also sort of hastily whisk Shadow away from the motel before he sees Laura, because obviously, like, his ravens are cawing, like, she's coming, okay. Get the fuck out of there, you know, like.
Listen, I'm about to climb up my own ass right here and say that those birds are not making raven noises. They never have. They're making crow noises. It's so annoying. If you've ever heard a raven, and if you've, like, never heard a raven before, and you heard one, you would be like, the fuck is that? Oh my god. Again, they're very impressive birds.
Do you want to approximate it right now? It's terrible. So let me reenact what happened, right? Brian Fuller is sitting in the editing bay and someone puts like an authentic raven noise on there and he's like, the fuck is that? We can't have that on a show. Make them sound like crows. Anyway.
They need to sound more hysterical. Ravens never sound hysterical.
So these crow ravens are cawing that Laura's coming and Wednesday's trying to whisk away. And so what this establishes Laura as, which I don't feel like she really directly was in the book, is Wednesday's main antagonist. Because we've got these new gods, but like something weird's going on with the new gods. Like, who knows what exactly is happening there. But
they,
like,
keep letting him go.
Right.
So,
but Wednesday's main obstacle, at least in this episode, well, yeah, I'd say I feel like the show is establishing Laura as Wednesday's main antagonist. And that's kind of cool because, like, as we've discussed before, she is a much smaller part in the books. She does not she's not very active, like, in all these different ways. And so, like, throughout the narrative, this part of the narrative, it's definitely not Laura versus Wednesday, you know? And so,
she's also so she's so focused on Shadow, the only thing in Laura's whole world. I mean, sort of, it's kind of, Laura Vision is kind of great because it actually highlights literally the fact that Laura just doesn't give a shit about anything except getting back to Shadow. So she's very single-minded. Unless Wednesday gets in her way, it doesn't seem like she cares at all about anything that any of these people might be doing. She doesn't even want to hear about it particularly.
Right. The thing that we do understand, you know, one of the questions that you and I had last week is, like, why does Laura even go into the morgue? Why is Mad Sweeney arrested? Like, what is the point of all of this narratively? And I'm not sure we have a satisfying narrative answer, but from a logistical point of view, the show needs them out of the way so that, you know, Wednesday can take Shadow back to the motel, say, see, she's gone, and get him out of there. So
can I also say that was, like, really, I don't know how you felt about it. I thought that was very poor editing. I don't know what was going on. I finally figured out that they had walked back to the motel.
Yeah. Not.
Sorry to nitpick.
Not at all. Not the cleanest of situations. But then we do get a sequence, you know, that's a lot of negativity, but I will say the sequence I do like, and between Laura and Mad Sweeney, and then eventually Salim, where Laura and Mad Sweeney need a car. Her car's been sort of impounded by the police because they think she's dead. It's not her car, right? It's Audrey's car, right?
Audrey's. Yeah, it's Audrey. Which,
Audrey can't catch a break.
How did Audrey get home?
We talked about this. Audrey just vanished into thin air when the story didn't hear anymore.
Did Laura eat her? Where did she go? I mean, in the book, she's supposed to show up again later. So, you know, it was Audrey just off the table now? I'd be sad to see Audrey go.
No. I
just think I'd be sad to find out that Audrey's in the trunk of her own car.
we've got Mad Sweeney, who likes to call Laura dead wife, which is actually very charming.
Quite endearing.
And she calls him Ginger Minge, which, as someone on Twitter pointed out to me, is a ridiculous thing for Laura Moon to call Mad Sweeney, because Minge is a British slang and an American girl wouldn't use it. And you certainly, like, and it's not like it's an Irish slang.
I was going to say, I don't know, she has some British heritage or something. Actually, I have an Irish friend who has frequently, she's told me, and she went to school in Ireland. She told me that she used to get called Ginger Minch by the kids. And I'm just like, wow, it seems like a kind of almost racist thing to call a person of Ireland, whatever. Anyway, I even if it's inaccurate, I do like it. So, I feel like if this was a different kind of show, they would have an unspoken thing.
Well, I feel like they have like a connection that I quite like. Like, I actually think she has more chemistry with him than she does with Ricky Whittle, who's playing Shadow. Sure. He promises her, he wants his coin back. He knows he's not going to get his coin back unless she, like, willingly gives it up to him. So he's like, how about we get you resurrected? And once you're resurrected, you don't need my stupid coin. You can give it back to me. And so he promises her some kind of nebulous resurrection. They run into Salim, who has been driving towards Mecca, which is the opposite direction of where, like, you don't drive from New York to Mecca and wind up in Ohio, but fine, whatever. They're in Salim's cab, and they're headed towards Kentucky. So this is their own little road trip. This is something that Pablo Schreiber, who plays Mad Sweeney, told me at Comic-Con last summer. He was like, well, Laura and Mad Sweeney go on a little road trip. I'm like, this feels like way more information than you're supposed to give me. So here's the road trip I was promised with Mad Sweeney and Laura. And I find that their scenes more compelling, actually, Wednesday in Shadow, unfortunately.
I do, so. Too. Like, I could watch a whole Laura Mad Sweeney road trip show. Yeah. And if they just kept picking up oddball characters along the way, I would find that pretty entertaining. I'm of two minds. I like the character of Salim so much. And I'm sorry, remind me of the actor's name who is playing Salim.
You keep talking and I will tell you. It's Omid Abtahi.
So he has... like, just the most ingenuous face. He is so innocent looking.
He's guys.
So beautiful. Yeah. and he's like really playing it up in every single glance that he directs at any character. But I was almost like, I don't know. I loved his vignette. I found it very touching all by itself. And it's sort of surprising to me actually to see it come back. One of the things in the book that was that made it sort of a fun, almost epistolary kind of style of book was that there were these vignettes that they had connections to the story, important connections, but they weren't like the characters didn't pop up. They were one and done characters. They brought the gods. They were mortal. They died. And then that was it. In doing so, Gaiman set the tone that they were, each of these individual mortal characters was one of thousands, hundreds of thousands of millions of people who came over and brought their individual beliefs with them. And so when Salim popped up again, I was like, oh yeah, Salim. But it was also, I felt that was a little contrived. I thought it was a bit of a departure from the character of the book, which has a sense of mass and history to it.
It is a sense of mass and history, but I also think it does have a strong sense of coincidence. So I don't know that or fate or destiny or however you want to put it. So I don't know that is entirely out of character, but I do agree with you that, like, and this is part of what Neil Gaiman talked about before when he said that American Gods was an unadaptable book. Like, he had just made it so weird with all these weird little, like, almost as an act of rebellion with all these weird little, like, side stories, and there's no way you could ever make a coherent thing out of it. And so it is completely untethered, those little Coming to America vignettes, and they are trying very hard to tether them. And we can probably take a long view of it at the end of the season and decide sort of, like, where the tethers work and they don't. Like, you know, for example, they Anansi is not one of the gods in the Coming to America. It's like Elegba, right, or something like that. And so, but they made it Anansi, and you know that Anansi's coming back. So it's sort of like that's a way, that's a tethering of like, let me insert this god who's pretty mm-hmm. close to this other African trickster god and like put him in this story versus let me take this character in the story and pull him out into the main narrative. So
I'll
be interested if we want to do a sort of little accounting of it when all is said and done.
Yeah.
That being said, I could just like stare at Celine like a darling face like forever. So,
he's so sweet.
Yeah. Okay, so then we get this scene. We get the answer to our question of what the hell was that chair thing last week when Shadow sort of reveals the wound in the side of him. A yet another side wound, which we've talked before is referencing Odin and Jesus, and any number of people. This time he's got a little thing in him that Odin has to pull out using some of his godly powers. And then in doing so, Odin tells a story of the god Mr. Wood, like, I really liked the phrasing of this was that mm-hmm. there's always been a god-shaped hole in man's head. Trees were the first to fill it. Mr. Wood was the trees. Mr. Wood was the forest. He was a very old god who saw something new. He sacrificed his trees and he sacrificed his forest and became something else. And, mm-hmm. this I didn't think it was done very clearly because, Shadow sort of like, right, like the first time I heard it, I was like, is he talking about Mr. Wood? Like, what is he talking mm-hmm. about? Like, I had to watch that scene a couple times, but it lays track for what we will see with Vulcan later in the episode, mm-hmm. this idea of an old god adapting to or rebranding or whatever. And becoming like less of a god of trees and more of a god of infrastructure, which is sort of what we kind of pegged those Mr. World henchmen as mm-hmm. in last week's episode when we were talking about it, right? Stone, Mr. Stone, Mr. Wood, Mr. Town, Mr. Road. I forget.
Yeah, Mr. Road.
Road. Okay, so there's the gods of infrastructure. So like that, Mr. Wood is an old god, an old tree god, basically, mm-hmm. who rebranded himself as a god of infrastructure. Rebranded himself as a new god.
As a god of building materials, of the things that we make. And I think Gaiman's on to something there. He personified each of those characters as sort of like local yokels, but.
I thought of them as spooks. I always thought of them as spooks. So.
I always thought of them as like either, CIA spooks or like sort of local law enforcement, like highway patrol and just like city cops, people who when you see them in film and television, they're just the whole character is the uniform.
Yeah.
Like the extra just has a certain stance and wears a uniform and you know exactly who that person is.
The sheriff in like every one-off episode of X-Files when they go to a town.
That guy.
Sheriff there. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
I can see him now. Anyway.
We get another scene. So
Not at all how Mr. Wood was portrayed in the book. And I think it was interesting because this portrayal in the show is very much the way that an old world god would behave as opposed to a god who is sort of sold out, if you will, franchised.
Yeah, so it's confusing. It's
weird.
That he's like acting as Mr. World's henchman, but still like quite so old god in his sort of demeanor and his like infecting Shadow tree goo. So
almost like a rogue god. Like he wasn't even on a side. Like I guess, there was a certain amount of buying into Mr. World's philosophy, but I don't know. He didn't really seem to be serving any purpose either way. I was confused about it.
So, Wednesday we see some of the, more persuasive, gentler powers that he has as he, rips this bit of wood out of Shadow. We get another scene with Salim and Laura and Mad Sweeney, and I was really glad that she, like, every time he, I'm going to use this word, I don't usually use it, but he's not American, so it's okay. Every time he calls her a cunt, It is kind of funny. Like, he calls her a leper cunt. And he's like, I've done the math. And it's like, you plus cunt or like whatever. Like, it's funny. But I was
one
also,
plus one divided by
equals you being a cunt. Like, whatever it was. It's funny, actually, both times he uses it. But I was also very glad for Laura to be like, you know what? Don't use the fucking word anymore. Like,
You're in America now. So,
you
don't say that.
So, sorry for your ears if me using that word offended anyone listening. But anyway, Matt Sweeney goes to sleep. Laura gently steers the car back towards Indiana from whence they came. Meanwhile, Wednesday and Chad go to Vulcan, Virginia, which is both the name of the town and the god and the factory and the company. And I don't know about you, but I have seen too many episodes of Pushing Daisies or Bones to not know that that guy was definitely going to end up in a vat. When it's like, when you have this, it was like a classic cold open of like a guy's looking so hot. They're playing Come On Get Happy as he's like walking to the factory. And I'm like, yeah, that dude's ending up in a vat.
Die.
Yeah. This we should mention, I think of all the departures this season is perhaps the biggest, just because it's like a huge,
this one has ramifications.
Yeah, it's a huge god that is show, I mean, not show invented, because Vulcan is a Roman god, Hephaestus is the Greek counterpart, god of blacksmithery and volcanoes. You know, that the show invented. And it's so funny, because it's like, the second time I watched it today for the second time, and like, it's very clever. It's very clever, like, for him to call the guns little volcanoes and each bullet a prayer, and, you know, where they say my name because his name's inscribed on it, and, like, the sacrifice of his factory workers in the vats, and Wednesday's description of the town and everyone's own America, especially coming off the back of this, like, really divided election that we had and all of that. Like, I'm not politicizing that. That's just, like, you know, no matter what size you fall on, you have to recognize that we do feel like a very divided America. And all of that is so smart. And yet, this whole thing really frustrated me, or didn't grab me the way that, like, the notion of it might grab me on the page. What did you think of it?
I was disappointed as soon as they pulled into the town, and I was like, oh, Corinthian columns, great. But even before that, there was a huge sign across the road that said Vulcan.
It's
not just the name of the town, it's the name of the factory. I mean, historically, there are some problems, like, with that. Like, did they name the factory after the town? Did the town spring up around the factory? If so, why does it look so
sometimes
old? You know, like, it's just, well, it's just,
there's,
you know,
Hershey, Pennsylvania. Like, these things happen.
Yeah, but, like, you know, Hershey, Pennsylvania, it was built around, chocolate's been around in the U.S. for X amount of years. Do you have that level of Corinthian columns? I don't know. Like, Virginia is a very apropos place to put, like, that type of architecture and that kind of history. You know, surrounding industry and surrounding tradition. I felt the whole thing was pretty ham-handed. There was just a lot of, it was very, very culty. There were a lot of, like, close shots on very hard-looking faces. Yeah. And I was like, listen, the show was taking, it was part of the overarching story. Like, there was obviously a religion surrounding guns, you know, in this particular town. They manufacture bullets.
I thought it would have
been more convincing if the people involved had been more human, more relatable. They all just, and they played the song, you know, You Put a Spell on Me. It seemed like everybody in the town, including the children, were completely hypnotized. There was like this Hitler Youth kind of thing going on with the armbands. And however you feel about gun control and about America's relationship with guns, in terms of convincing me that this was a, you know, anything more than like a magic spell, you know, that this god needed something from these people, it kind of fell flat to me. It didn't really feel like this was a sustainable or realistic scenario for this god to have been surviving on for any period of time. You know, wouldn't somebody have noticed? I don't know. That's a weird question to ask in America today, but whatever.
Well, you know, it is something that I want to talk to you about because this is another way in which we are culturally divided because yeah. I have like a strong fear of an aversion to guns. I don't even want to touch them. And your family likes to go to the shooting range. I wouldn't call them gun nuts by any stretch of the imagination, but like gun culture is something that exists, I think, to like a rational degree in your family. And then
yeah.
I would say that there are some gun owners or there is, I will say this, there is a gun culture in America that isn't rational. That's not to say like hashtag not all gun owners. Like it's not true of everyone who owns a gun or likes to go to the shooting range or likes to hunt or whatever. But it is true that some people like that. There are people who believe that Sandy Hook was like, you know, constructed just to take your guns away. Like that's crazy. That is a crazy thing to believe. And so that is a thing that exists in this country. There are crazy people who like have this affinity towards gun, like have made guns.
For whom guns equate freedom.
Yeah. And that is the America that they believe in. And that's sort of like what Wednesday's talking about and what Vulcan's talking about when he's like, every gunman in a movie theater is a prayer to me. And every one of those prayers makes people want to pray harder, which is true because there's people like, well, if someone had a gun when that gunman opened fire, then it wouldn't have been a problem. You know, it's like fight gun with gun and like all this stuff. So anyway, I'm getting a little worked up because of my gun. But, but you know, like I can understand why maybe you or your husband or your brothers or your dad or all these people that you know and love that I respect as well who like guns might see that as like a very terrible caricature of themselves, like reflected in American Gods, you know.
excuse me.
And it's not something that has my backup, but it's something that I was interested to talk to you about.
I know some people. So, you know, my family, when I was a kid, I remember like my dad, we would go on these long road trips and we did for, I don't know why, honestly, because it like when I was growing up, we like there was a 22 in the house. My dad was ex Air Force. And he came from a military family. They were all Air Force. But it wasn't, you know, like we never went to the shooting range as kids. I went to the shooting range with the Girl Scouts. Like that was my first exposure to guns at all. But I do remember like we went on the, you know, we would go on these cross country road trips. And I do remember like my dad, for whatever reason, one time took the 22 and we were out in like the Nevada desert. And we like shot some bottles. And it was, you know, sort of educational to know how to load and fire a 22 rifle.
Right.
My brothers like black powder guns and have a collection of them. They also have some hunting guns that they presumably go hunting with. I don't know.
I've never heard them tell a hunting story, not once.
I don't think they do. But like they're definitely like casual gun, interaction. I do, however, know some people who are on the crazy side of like the whole guns equal freedom thing. And I find it, I find it extremely perturbing. I think that to me, it speaks to an idea of personal freedom that is very isolating. That you look at the world and feel the need constantly to know that you could defend yourself with lethal force against it. And I don't feel that way. And I know that like my family members don't feel that way either. The fact that I personally don't like or interact with guns. I don't go to the shooting range outside of a Girl Scout experience or shooting bottles in the desert, which I don't know, like that was sort of fun. I was probably 12. It had no like lethal force connotations with it. However, I do know people who do very much subscribe to that. And I think that those people would have been highly offended by that scene or not understood.
Not recognize themselves in it.
Yeah, not seeing themselves in it and understood that the show was saying very much that this was a bad thing, that this was cultish, that this was equal to a blood sacrifice cult that perpetuated the spilling of blood, which is what I saw in the show. Yeah. I think that it was a portrayal, somewhat ham-handed, of a mentality that sees the world as something to be feared and defended against.
Well, what's one of my favorite lines, which sort of kicked off a fun thought experiment for me, and you know, if you guys are listening, want to try it. Wednesday says, you know, there aren't just two Americas. Everyone looks at Lady Liberty and sees a different face. And I'm going to paraphrase here because I didn't write down the full quote, but it's like, nobody wants to give up the warm, safe feeling that their America gives them. And so, like, that's very easy for me to understand from this, like, gun cult perspective. It's like, what makes, you know, what makes me feel warm and safe is my gun, and I feel protected, and I feel like I can protect my family, and that is important to me. So I understand that. But then I was like, okay, Joanna, what is your warm, safe America feeling? Like, if you don't have this sort of, like, instinct towards defending the homestead, like, what is America to you, and what makes you feel safe there? And I think, for me, it's this, like, very, very gross liberal Bay Area, like, has to do with, like, compassion and everyone's welcome here and stuff like, and that's the America that I believe in, that's the America that I recognize, and I don't recognize this other America, you know? And so, I don't know, it's a fun little game to play of, like, okay,
what's your America?
What feels, like, inalienably America to you, and, like, you know, when you see it reinforced, which we do sometimes, like, if we see, like, for me, if I see a protest at the airport and, you know, I see people of different faiths joining hands to welcome other immigrants who were maybe kept away for a bit because of a travel ban of a certain person, like, that's me. I'm like, that's my America. Or, like, about a million things that Barack Obama did, I was like, that's my America. You know what I mean? And now there's a lot that I don't recognize. And that's, I mean, it's just a large, complicated problem that we're all, on both sides, all grappling with. Okay. So we get the, this has been a weird episode.
It's a loaded episode.
Definitely.
It really is. No pun intended.
we get this hail of bullets.
We all wonder about that. We always wonder, you know, in the scene, you know, in the saloon, do they all stick in the ceiling? Eventually bullets have to come down.
That's what Diana said when they fired all the guns in the air. She's like, those are going to come back down at one point. And I was like, lo and behold, they did. There's this hail of bullets. Shadow's protected. I do really like the casting of Corbin Burnson as Vulcan, as this sort of, like, seeming ex-army. Everyone's great. I'm like, your grandpa's like that. My grandpa's like that. Not yours, Gail, but, like, I don't know. It's a grandpa I recognize.
I'm trying to think of any of my grandpas. I have a lot.
You do. His face, kind of when he sees Shadow, which could be a number of things, but another thing that I wanted to talk about in this episode is, which we've dabbled in a little bit, but really how much the show is leaning into Shadow's racial identity as a problem as he travels through America, which I don't remember it really being in the book, but, this coming back to this idea of lynching over and over again, and then this whole, like, hanging tree thing in front of Vulcan's house, and the way that everyone sort of glares at Shadow in this town makes him feel so uneasy and unwelcome. And it really does. I mean, it feels like Vulcan has his own, like, various side things that he's working, but, like, his weird reaction to Shadow does feel racially motivated to me. And, that's just something
The
show's leaning into. So,
and I thought he sort of prodded that wound a couple of times, actually, throughout the rest of, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to disagree with me, to be honest, that was a theme of, you know, lynching was something that was brought up, like, And Shadow even says, "Did you know? Did you tell him that I was?"
And that's how Shadow, I think, figured. Well, Wednesday has already cottoned on to the fact that, like, Vulcan is just insulting him left and right. Vulcan won't drink
so early on.
Like, all sort of stuff like that.
Or you know, and, okay, really quickly, can we talk about the drink? This is not something that I recognize. He keeps calling it Soma.
Yeah.
What is it? I know I'm supposed to be the one who knows about mythology. I don't know anything about this thing. I don't know what it is. Unless it's like the, you know, the bead of poetry or something like that, which seems like a weird gift, although very precious. I don't know what this thing is, but it seems it has been brought up a couple of times and it is clearly very significant. And I almost want to say that one of the reasons that Vulcan won't drink it is because it's sort of like breaking bread or, you know, certain pacts that you make of hospitality that you don't break,
right,
without some kind of traditional consequence, without shame or whatever.
To drink the Soma is to sort of like ally himself with, okay, when Soma was made, I mean, I'm sorry, my source right now is cannabisculture.com, so I do apologize, but apparently it's like a Vedic sort of Zoroastrian drink. Okay. But the identity of the ancient plant known as Soma is one of the greatest unsolved mysteries in the fields of religious history. Common in the religious lore of both ancient India and Persia, the sacred Soma plant was considered a god. When Soma was pressed and made into a drink, the ancient worshiper who imbibed it gained the powerful attributes of this god.
Well, this is then sort of in line with the mead that came from, you know, Bragi and Odin's mead adventures, which we discussed in a previous episode, but... yeah, it sounds like probably it's something in line with that.
Yeah, so Vulcan won't drink it, and I agree. It sort of feels like a bread and salt sort of situation.
Yeah, he's an old god. He can't help but play by the rules to some extent.
But he's levying all these jabs at both Shadow and Wednesday, because he has been bought by the new gods. He has alerted them to the fact that Shadow and Wednesday are there, and he is, he's an old god who has been rebranded, which is sort of what we talked about with Mr. Wood, and I think something we'll see again. And it's not something that I remember the book really dealing with that much. Like the new gods have been offered that to Odin, but like, you know, here's a god that took them up on their offer, and he is reaping the rewards. Like, this is a show invented thing, but Vulcan is reaping the rewards of selling out to the new gods. They rebranded him as the god of like guns, and it's perfect. It's so clever on the page, and it just doesn't work as well as I would like to in the episode, but it is very, very clever on the page.
I think one of the other things, and this is a personal thing for me, one of the other things that did not sit well with me about the portrayal of Vulcan was the fact that he just seemed to have no shame at all, no regrets that he had taken this, you know, Odin said in, it was the last episode, he says to Mr. World, you know, while he's talking to media, he says, yeah, you occupy their time. We gave back. We gave them meaning, which is a very, like, you know, godlike, hubristic thing to say. But still, I think that's how a lot of the old gods see themselves and value themselves within the framework of this story is we had something to offer. We didn't just take. We're forced to now, but we still have something to offer, something that's valuable. And so Vulcan in this depiction, you know, Hephaestus, I'm not as up on the Roman gods because they seemed, frankly, like the Roman gods sort of seem like the ancient world sellouts to me. But they're the original rebranding, and they had like their adherents in that respect. The sort of cult like town of Vulcan is you know kind of on the money with a militaristic Roman adherence to you know one of the iterations of the Roman pantheon. But Hephaestus was actually like not, you wouldn't, I don't know. I don't think of Hephaestus as being like a blood sacrifice god. He was a hard working god. He had a very unhappy marriage, which was not his fault at all.
All I think about in terms of Hephaestus is like being cuckolded by goddamn Aphrodite and
the terrible, dreadful god of war, Ares. He's the guy that you love to hate because he's awful. He's handsome. He's sort of admittedly awful in Greek mythology. But Hephaestus, I mean, it would be almost much more reasonable to have Ares or Mars portraying this character within the framework of the show because, you know, Hephaestus or Vulcan, they have more, they sort of have a work ethic thing about them. And you know, he never takes Aphrodite to the mat, you know.
Like, I disagree because, like, I think that, yeah, well, no, I don't disagree about, you're right in your characterization of Hephaestus, but, like, I disagree. I think, A, it's too irresistible to have the blacksmithing god not be, like, the god of guns. Like, that's, it's not, the god of war does also translate, but the god, the blacksmithing god makes more sense. But, I don't think these old gods who are tempted to rebrand and ally themselves with the new gods, I don't think they necessarily need to start as bad old gods. I think there's a corrupting influence of new godery that, you know what I mean, could take a god like Hephaestus, who we kind of like, you know, is sad. I think he's like slightly crippled.
He's a little pathetic. Like, yeah. He is. Yeah. He was. And you know how he got crippled? I'll lay a little knowledge on you. You knew this already. But
you're the worst.
It's true.
You're the worst.
No, it was because he was trying to stop his mommy and daddy from fighting.
Yeah.
And his crappy dad threw him across the world and he landed really hard in an island.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah.
It's a nice boy, man. He just wanted everyone to get along.
Hephaestus is a lovely god that we like to root for, and now he's become this terrible person. But that's okay. Because Wednesday is going to slice his head off with this, like, really ugly sword that has been made for him. I don't know. Like,
such an anime sword.
I know. I don't know if I'm just, like, spoiled by the armory on Game of Thrones or what, but I was like, this sword is not.
But I mean, even Vikings. Like, we've got Vikings right now, right? You know, like, we've got this, like, National Geographic approved, History Channel approved episode, you know, series about Vikings. Can't we just kind of steal some of their concept? Do we have to? Or maybe, I don't know, concept from the actual Vikings? Do we have to?
I'm not a fan of this sword, but God, I am sorry, guys. And we're so negative on this episode. We should note, we learned in this episode that Shadow has the ability to see Laura sort of wherever she is. He can close his glowing little eyeballs and sort of land on where she is. Once again, Laura, like, I do like the Laura and Mad Sweeney stuff, but it did feel a little, like, tail-chasey. Like, she goes back to Indiana and goes to her home, and they're back at the Crocodile Bar, which felt like they needed to reuse that set or something like that. Like, I don't know why they're back at the Crocodile Bar.
I liked hearing her and Mad Sweeney talk, you know, about mortality and about her relationship with Shadow, because, yeah, I'm always greedy for more of Laura's insights into her human relationships, especially after death, now that she has, like, absolutely nothing but her relationship with Shadow to lose. She doesn't, and she says a number of times, I have no shame. But it was really super weird that they went back to that bar. It was almost like she's tracing Shadow's footsteps just in the wrong direction.
Well, it felt to me like,
how did she even know they were there?
No, she wanted to go see her family. Like, it was.
Well, why did she go to the Crocodile Bar? Like, how?
Because it's
why,
on the way. I don't know.
Is it some famous landmark bar that everyone goes to?
Indiana. I don't know what to tell you.
It's the only one. I've never been to Indiana. It's the only bar.
Yes, there's just this one bar in Indiana.
All bar scenes in Indiana.
They have a lovely, charming conversation about anal sex. And no, but I do, like, for all the anal sex, whatever, aside, like, Mad Sweeney saying, like, your love is the kind of love where, like, even if it, like, even the person doesn't want it, even if it upsets them, you're just going to, like, do it anyway. And I was like, that's
how I felt. Remember I said in an earlier podcast about that scene where she, like, forces her way into Audrey's bathroom and she's just like, I'm so sorry, but this is how it has to be. Yeah. Like, Laura's really very disrespectful of other people's lives and space. Just doesn't give a shit. She is very, as I said, she's very single-minded, and it's kind of scary, actually. That is probably the most disturbing thing to me about the character and about her interactions with people, is that at some point she has the power and the ability to just force herself into people's lives.
Yeah, and it feels to me, what's really, really interesting to me is it feels like Matt Sweeney 1,000% has her number in a way that Shadow never did. And yep. So, you know, you were talking about if we were watching a different show, they'd have a very special connection or something like that. But, like, I really just genuinely think they do. Like, whether or not it winds up being romantic or sexual or whatever, you know, whatever liberties the show wants to take, Mad Sweeney understands Laura Moon in a way that her husband never did. And that's compelling to watch, I think. And so we go back to Vulcan, Virginia, where Wednesday kills Vulcan and sort of talks about how he's going to create this false narrative that, like, Vulcan swore allegiance to Wednesday and was killed by the new gods for doing so. And that's the sort of story. He's going to make a martyr of Vulcan, a cautionary tale to the other old gods of, like, you know, this is what the new gods will do to you if you swear your affection to me, but you should because, you know, they're monsters. We get a repeat of the earlier Vat death where, like, basically bits of Vulcan, melty Vulcan, go into all the bullets. And but this batch has been cursed by Wednesday. He has peed on the Vat. So we don't know what exactly that means for those bullets, whether or not that's going to come up in this show or it's just a general sort of thing. I don't know. But yeah, he lays on a curse. And then Shadow freaks the fuck out, and once again I'm just like, what is it that bothers you, Shadow, and what is it that doesn't?
I can imagine Shadow being like, what the hell, why did you do that? But for him to have been,
I guess this is the first murder.
He had a tree inside him and his wife came back from the dead, and she's like completely, she's got the, you know, giant vivisection wife stitches all over her, and I just feel like Shadow, I don't know, maybe this is some kind of manifestation of shock or post-traumatic stress that we are witnessing.
I guess it's the first murder that he's
I'm trying to think.
Like, but
has he seen anyone else die?
But still, I'm just like, but do you realize that you're seeing a god die? And so does it really count if it's a god? I mean, like, I don't know. And that's certainly where we get the name of this episode, which is The Murder of Gods, which is, you know, a reference to A Murder of Crows, but also the...
Oh, by the way, Ravens Travel and Slaughters.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's really funny. And then the episode ends with Salim praying and Laura and Mad Sweeney sort of watching him the end. As they like leave Indiana and are maybe now going to Kentucky, which is what Mad Sweeney wanted all along. So why did they go to Indiana? So that Laura could, I guess, have some closure with her mother, but that doesn't really, like, I just feel like they could
I feel like
hindsight's 2020, but if I were writing this episode, they would have just continued along to Kentucky for a while and stopped and had these conversations along the way at various diners. Like, that's fine. But, like, the trip to Indiana feels like more wheel spinning in a season that just, like, really doesn't quite know the full thrust of its story, you know?
I almost feel like the writers are feeling constrained by the 1 hour. Because I would love to give the benefit of the doubt and say that some of the things that don't seem to make very much sense in these episodes, like Laura going back to her family home, we saw already in the really well-constructed montage of Laura and Shadow talking, that Laura's mother does not approve at all of Ricky. Mm-hmm. Or excuse me, of Shadow. Mm-hmm. I don't think we really needed to see that Laura grew up in this massive mansion and that she didn't particularly like her family or feel like she belonged to them, unless that's going to come up later. And if it is going to come up later, maybe we didn't need to cram all of this reference to Laura's, you know, sort of unhappiness with her childhood into this episode. We could have left it, or maybe the episode needed to be longer if this is an important thing that we're going to return to. And if it's not an important thing that we're going to return to, then it's just incongruous. It's unnecessary. We could have watched more packets of Virginia Slim slowly float through the air.
More bullets go through the machine.
More smoke waft out of an open car window.
But yeah, I think it's safe to say, I think what's happening right now is I really feel like the show peaked with the Laura episode, which, you know, that I liked you know, you liked it. I like loved it. Mm-hmm. And for me, the messiness of these two subsequent episodes are bumming me out a little bit, because it felt like that lore episode was very controlled. It was just, it felt like mm-hmm. like its own little film almost. And
yeah, it was a little bubble.
Yeah, and so I don't know. Hopefully the show will sort of, you know, and please do email us at stormofspoilers@gmail.com if you disagree, if you're loving everything mm-hmm. you see, if the Vulcan stuff really worked for you, if the gun control stuff was really, like, really stuck the landing for you and didn't feel ham-fisted, like, any of that. We would love to hear your feedback. But for me right now, it feels like the show is floundering. I know that they struggled with episode length in this season, not running time per episode, but 8 episodes versus 10 episodes. I know that we're building towards a climax that they didn't like expect to write, like all this stuff. Like, I am actually very willing. I am still quite optimistic for an American God season 2, because I am very willing for a show to have a lot of growing pains in season 1 and really figure out what it can and can't do.
I thought they had already signed for season 2.
Oh, they have. Yeah, they have.
Okay. No, I just mean, like, it's inconceivable to me.
No, I just mean that whenever someone like gets really frustrated with the season 1, I just think about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, my favorite show of all time, and sure. how its first mm-hmm. season is kind of garbage town sometimes. So, you know.
It was such a game changer too.
so, you know.
It was.
So American Gods season 2 could be perfect. We don't know. But right now I'm struggling a little bit with it. So we will see. Anything else you want to talk about, Gail, before we go? Before we leave our listeners on that total bummer note.
On this, like, super downer of a complaining episode. Oh, my God. Was there anything else I wanted to say? Hang on just a second. No, I will only say, I don't know, my favorite Vulcan of all time, and this is probably why I'm a little skewed on this particular thing, in addition to feeling like I just wish that it had been a little bit more relatable, and I'm not a gun person. It just, you know, I was born and raised in San Francisco Bay Area, so I'm pretty far left. Not quite as far as Joanna, but still. it was sort of like, well, I could just sort of like make my own assumptions and not watch this whole part and be perfectly right according to the show. I didn't get anything from this. My favorite Vulcan of all time is Oliver Reed in Baron Munchausen, which is like as far removed, still like not a very positive character. Very violent and a weaponsmith, and has a great speech, actually. This is a great character, and if we're talking about gods franchising themselves, people have all kinds of problems with and arguments with Baron Munchausen, the Terry Gilliam film, as a film. That being said, Oliver Reed's Vulcan has a great speech about the ease with which people can kill each other in a modern context. And he is manufacturing in his volcano nuclear warheads. And it's funny in a Terry Gilliam kind of way. But for all the problems that that film has historically, that was a much more successful depiction of a god having sold out, really, to modern sensibilities. It's not about the quality of the killing. It's about how many people you kill. And that was also what media and Mr. World and the technical boy, sulkily, were trying to pitch in the previous episode, was having your name on it is just as good. It, you know, quantity is better than quality. You know, you might kill one person with a sword, but look at how many people you can kill with a nuclear warhead, even if they don't ever know the name on the warhead. Right. They'll all add up to. And this is it's a game and thing also, like, you know, maybe spoiler territory, I don't know, but it's something in Good Omens that is discussed in the very first chapter of that, you know, Gaiman Pratchett collaboration.
Joint.
It's, yeah. it's there's this constant question between the old gods and the new gods of quantity versus quality. And I don't know if that's sort of how I'm processing the show's attempts to look at this franchising, the merger offered to the old gods. And I don't think it's as successful as it could be. I think it's a really strong, interesting point to make, but I want to see them explore it a little bit more convincingly.
Okay. Well, that is it for us this week. We've got two more episodes left. next week is called, I remember the names being interesting. Hold on, let me look them up. Next week's episode is called A Prayer from Matt Sweeney. Oh, yeah. This We Know. This We Know from the interview that I did with Neil Gaiman is the Essie Tregowan, whose name I think has changed for the show. Essie McGowan, I think, from Tregowan. But anyway, Essie's Coming to America. And then the last one is called Come to Jesus. So this is we're barreling down towards the end of season one of American Gods. Thank you guys so much for listening to us. Until next week, Gail, where can people find your work? Or you don't do work, sorry. You do work, just not
I don't
online.
Do work.
Sorry, that's my nope. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, which has very little to do with my work.
Oh my god, so much work, guys.
My Twitter handle is at @clockworkrose.
Oh, nobody works harder. Okay, you can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can hear me talking about Twin Peaks over on Peaks TV. You can hear me talking about any manner of things over on Little Gold Men. And we are doing a complete Game of Thrones rewatch. We are now in season three. Jesus. We are now in season three on Storm Spoilers. So you can catch up. With
full disclosure. I work very hard, but Joanna Robinson definitely works harder than me.
I don't know about that. Until next week, only the gods are real.